Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi and thank you for joining me, Mike Dilk, on this week's Relax Back UK show. Now, COVID-19 is still with us, but the effects are much less now. My guest is one of the people who really did work tirelessly throughout the peak of the pandemic to help overcome it. He's Professor Nick Lemoine, CBE. And in March 2020, he was appointed chair of the Urgent Public Health Group.
The purpose of that was to identify, fund and deliver the key studies that would develop diagnostics, therapeutics and vaccines for the virus, which was a real challenge because at that time we really knew almost nothing about it.
It is easy to forget how unknown it all was, just how lost and worried many of us felt, and what a scary time it was.
It was like being in a war room, frankly. And the reason we met in the evenings was because all of our specialists were involved in frontline care for patients with COVID.
However, we did get through the worst. Discoveries were made, vaccines trialled, and existing drugs repurposed to treat the disease.
It saved, in that first year alone, 22,000 lives in the UK and a million worldwide.
Please do stay tuned to hear more of the story and the very large part that Professor Nick Lemoine played in all of this. Thank you. On the show, I often talk to people who have achieved great things, helped people, added to the body of scientific and medical knowledge. In short, people that are real doers. Professor Nick Lemoine is absolutely no exception to this. My first question to him was, what has he been doing since the start of the COVID pandemic?
My day job is as director of the Barts Cancer Institute at Queen Mary University of London. So I'm a cancer specialist, but I'm also the part-time medical director for the National Institute for Health and Care Research, Clinical Research Network, which is an organization that supports typically about 5,000 studies clinical trials and other research studies across England. But in that role, I was asked at the beginning of the pandemic by Sir Chris Whitty, the Chief Medical Officer for the UK, to head up the urgent public health research response to COVID-19. And I took up that role in March 2020, which seems a long time ago now. I'm sure it does for everybody.
Yeah, a lot has happened since then, hasn't it? Yeah.
It has indeed. And the purpose of that was to identify, fund and deliver the key studies that would develop diagnostics, therapeutics and vaccines for the virus, which was a real challenge because at that time we really knew almost nothing about it. As I mentioned, typically the Clinical Research Network, supported by the National Institute for Health and Care Research, which I'll call NIHR from now on, if that's all right with you, Mike.
Yes, good plan.
We've got it out of the way. We typically support about 5,000 studies in routine practice. But the instruction from government was to focus entirely on COVID-related studies until we had overcome the disease and come out of the pandemic emergency. So we established a group, the Urgent Public Health Group, which consisted of over 70 individuals. So clinical specialists in respiratory diseases, intensive care, care of the elderly, musculoskeletal diseases, a range of different specialists. And we had to call on a variety of them during the pandemic, as well as the leaders of the what's called UCSA, it was called Public Health England then, it's now being called the UK Health Security Agency, the NHS organisations, as well as representatives from the devolved administrations and patient representatives, which was really important for us to have a grounding in what were the questions that they wanted answered. Yeah. And that group met three times a week in the evening, so after 6 o'clock, sometimes on a Sunday. We met on Easter Sunday in 2020 because we had so much work to do to identify what were the research questions.
You've just described sort of what you did in a few sentences very quickly, sort of glossing over the fact that, you know, this must have been all encompassing, like massive amount to do, with also the thought that, hang on, if this doesn't work, possibly we're all doomed. I mean, this sounds like, you know, this is not an easy walk in the park. This sounds like a major, major deal. And I'm surprised you still got kind of a smile on your face.
Well, I have to say, you can't do serious business without having a laugh sometimes, but it was very difficult in those challenging times, not least when you tended to get calls on this, Mike.
The red phone.
The red phone.
Oh, my God.
It's direct line to Chris Whitty. It was a very pressured time. And
how often did the red line go?
In those days, in that first year of the pandemic, at least once a day. And it was like being in a war room, frankly. And the reason we met in the evenings was because all of our specialists were involved in frontline care for patients with COVID. So over the course of that first year, we identified 100 research studies to conduct. And they were a variety of things. As I mentioned, we were focused on developing therapeutics, but also when they were developed, delivering the trials that showed that vaccines were effective. We conducted in that first year, 8 clinical trials of vaccines in the UK, and a variety of different therapeutics protocols.
So this is when someone's, you know, really ill in intensive care with COVID, things to keep alive, because, you know, this hadn't occurred before. Yeah.
Well, since you've mentioned intensive care, let's work back from there. So we had a study that was already going on called REMAP-CAP, which is led from Imperial College. That was already open, actually, for patients in intensive care who had severe pneumonia. But we repurposed it for COVID. Identified a number of therapeutics that improved outcomes very substantially, and that included steroids as well as anticoagulants drugs that repurpose the immune system, which we
repurposing sounds like the way to go, because you already know what the side effects are and that these drugs don't just kill people, I suppose.
Exactly, Mike. So that we focused very much on the art of the possible. So this was not about discovering, at that time, it was not about discovering new agents and then taking them through all the development pathway that involves. And typically, if you're developing a new agent from scratch, it typically takes more than 7 years to get something licensed. We weren't in that position. We didn't have that luxury. So we needed to see if drugs that we already had in the pharmacy could be useful for knowing what we do about viral diseases anyway, and learning what we did about the importance of an overactive immune reaction. How could we find drugs that would interfere with either or both of those processes?
Right.
Okay. The big study that I'm sure many of your readers, your listeners will have heard about, is the recovery study. So this has been described. I was speaking yesterday at a meeting with the Canadian Ministry of Health, and they described this study as something that had changed the world. And almost all of the recruitment to this study was in the UK. So recovery was looking at patients who'd been admitted to hospital, so they were seriously ill, but not in intensive care. And that originally had a recruitment target of 30,000 individuals. And it was a multi-arm trial, what's called a platform trial. So it started with two different agents, two different drugs that we already had in the pharmacy, and tried those in parallel. ultimately ended up looking at 8 different drugs during that first year. And so it had a target originally of 30,000 patients. In that first year, it actually recruited 48,000 people in hospital.
So were these 48,000 people scattered around hospitals in the UK?
So this is one of the remarkable things about the NIHR Clinical Research Network. That study was run in every single general hospital in the country. So the firepower we were able to bring to bear on this problem was immense. We employ about 6,500 staff across England, we had research ready staff in every hospital, and it was an astonishing effort. And we're very grateful to all the patients who consented to take part in that study, because it did change the world. Right. So the first drug to be shown to be effective was something called dexamethasone. Now, this is a very commonly used steroid. So it's an immune suppressant, essentially. And it reduced the likelihood of death by 30%. So 1 in 3 people who would have died were saved by this drug.
That was one of the questions I was going to ask you. And I thought that's probably an impossible question, almost embarrassing to ask. But I'll ask it anyway. And you kind of half answered it there, because of all this work that you did looking at repurposing drugs and also the vaccines, which I'll ask you about in a moment. Is there an estimate of just how many lives were saved through all this?
Well, it's not my estimate, but it is by the world's statisticians. And the World Health Organization, the WHO, has estimated it that in that first year of the pandemic, that discovery, that finding, which Sir Chris Whitty issued guidance the day after the result was announced, that this should become routine practice for patients who've been admitted with COVID-19. It saved, in that first year alone, 22,000 lives in the UK and 1 million worldwide. And that was just in the... So it was remarkable. And the cost of a course of dexamethasone, £5.
Money well spent.
I would say it's for those people who were able to leave hospital. And it was close on a miracle to get that discovery so early in the pandemic.
So obviously there are a lot of people involved in doing this, but pretty much... you were at the rudder, you were at the helm, kind of sorting this out. That's fair to say, isn't it?
Well, I chaired the group, but I was not alone. You're quite right. We have around 5,000 clinical specialists across the country. Sorry, about 500 clinical specialists across the country that we can call on for help in giving advice, expert advice. Yeah. And this was a collective effort with the Medical Research Council, the NIHR, the Wellcome Trust, and other funders, as well as all our colleagues across the NHS and in social care.
Right. So lots of people were involved, but Nick, you were the guy with the red phone. And actually, I just want to say this, because I know you're not going to. You were awarded a CBE for this, weren't you?
I was. I was very privileged and honoured to receive it on behalf of my colleagues. But yes, I was.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that. I think we can only say kind of well-deserved, so kind of miraculous work. So moving on, you mentioned some of the drugs that you repurposed, this one in particular. Out of all these trials you did, you were also working on trials for vaccines as well. That's correct, yeah?
That's right. Yeah. So as well as the one we started first was for the AstraZeneca agents that were developed by the world experts at the University of Oxford. And we were able to roll those out very quickly and using innovative approaches. So we opened vaccine hubs in sports halls, in libraries, in hospitals, in GP practices. And we were able to get those over the line very quickly indeed. and as well as the other agents, the from Moderna and others that people will be receiving now. Many of the recruits were in this country, but obviously there was a more worldwide effort for those ones.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
You managed to do these trials incredibly quickly. Was that just because of the kind of sense of urgency and, you know, the red phone, or was anything else different? You know, because, you know, Joe Public, you know, me, I hear of trials. You know, in fact, you said it takes 7 years for something to kind of come to fruition. And it all happened in a matter of kind of weeks almost, or maybe months. Was anything different, or was it just a sense of urgency?
We were absolutely laser focused on these studies, so that we had to close down almost all other clinical research while this was going on for that first year, until we're out of the emergency phase. So we are very lucky in this country to have a National Health Service. I know it's got its problems, which we're experiencing at the moment. However, the fact that we can pivot the whole organization to undertake what is needed to overcome this this emergency was something that we're very proud of. And actually, the British public are very open to research, clinical research. And we all remember, you know, watching the evening briefings from Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance and the Prime Minister. And when the results were announced about recovery and some of the other studies too, that was a really motivating experience for all of us. And I think people were just absolutely up for anything that would enable us to overcome the horror of that first year of the pandemic. Actually, in routine practice, you know, we every year we recruit something approaching a million people to clinical research studies in the UK, which is remarkable. So people are open to doing things that might not benefit themselves individually, but for the good of others. And actually, in that first year, those 100 studies that we focused on, they recruited over a million people. Over a million people in that first year.
So all those people were in the UK?
Yes.
Okay, the great British public. So that's like one in 70 people.
Yes.
Volunteered for, I was going to say to be experimented on, that's not quite the right phrase, to take part in a trial.
That's right. This is not being experimented. I wouldn't want you to think that. This is, we had nothing at the start of the pandemic. We knew nothing. And this was to find things that, as you mentioned, were known safe agents for the drugs and well-tested technology for the vaccines. So these were things that some people were on anyway, not the vaccines, but some of these drugs. So we knew them really well. And that reassurance that we could give people that was really important part of this process.
Yeah, certainly. No, anyway, the great British public. Let's move on a little bit and ask you some more questions, really more about some of the vaccines, because essentially we've been pretty used to vaccines working for us, you know, with polio and, you know, there are many, many success stories. And but with COVID, you know, you can have the vaccine. I'm fully jabbed up. No, actually, I have had COVID a couple of times, and so has my wife. And recently, she had COVID again. So, I suppose the question is: are we dealing with something different? You know, is COVID a harder virus to deal with, or, you know, it just seems slightly different?
Yes. So it. As you mentioned, we've eradicated smallpox many years ago, but COVID, it comes from a class of viruses which are are mutate. They change their surface membrane very quickly, and that makes it a moving target, essentially. So the virus that we experienced in the first wave is not the one that is in circulation now, and I think people know that. And that's why the current vaccine rollout is with altered versions of the original vaccines to take account of the fact that the virus has moved on. And no vaccine for most viruses is completely protective. And while most of us will generate, will mount an antibody response to the vaccine that will also be an antibody response against the virus, it's not rock solid. And we should remember, and it needs boosting, which is why after you've had your first dose, you then have a booster and then another booster. And now, obviously, many people are receiving a further booster with the altered vaccine to take account of the new strain.
Right.
But we should remember that there's about 1 million people in this country who are immunosuppressed for a variety of reasons. Either because they're on cancer treatments or they've had a kidney transplant or they just naturally have a weak immune response. And that's a real problem because those people are not capable of mounting an antibody response in the same way that most people can. And that is still an issue. And that's why some people are still shielding and just avoiding public contact because they don't have that protection.
I mean, so what can they do? They can't do much more than shield at them presently. Or have you got something up your sleeve to help them as well?
Well, there are ways. So one of the approaches that's been used has been to use convalescent serum. So taking blood from people who've mounted a really good immune response to the virus, and purifying the antibodies from that, and then giving that to patients in order to give them an exogenous, an artificial boost with antibodies from somebody else. And also we're running trials for preventive or protective drugs as well, so antivirals that have been identified. So, but it's a challenge, and as you see, you know, it hasn't gone away. It's just shifted.
Sure. Well, the not going away is something that I'm keen to ask you a little bit as well. So, two things really. There's long COVID, but also people that have COVID badly. I've spoken to friends, and indeed my wife when she had COVID. The last time, the thing that really worries people or seems to worry them is this brain fog, you know, because actually you can understand if you've got a fever or you feel a bit achy. But when you have this real brain fog, you start thinking, you know, what's causing this and will it ever go? You know, am I going to be like stuck with this, forgetting things forever? Yeah. So is there any... does anyone know why this sort of brain fog occurs? Because it seems to be a symptom that really worries a lot of people.
Yes, I chaired the National Expert Group on Long COVID, which we started at Christmas time in 2020.
I had a suspicion I'd be talking to the right guy, actually, Nick.
So it became evident that, as you say, the symptoms were not going away. And long COVID essentially is described as or defined as those who still have persistent symptoms more than 12 weeks, up more than 3 months after their initial infection. And that's a substantial proportion of people, actually. So it's at least 10% of people. Particularly those who are female, and those who are middle aged, and also have other conditions. And the brain fog, we don't fully know why that is. There are various things that have been investigated and found to be there. So Some of it is about the inflammation that occurs generally as a result of COVID, and we know that the virus does infect nerve cells, which is probably why loss of taste and loss of smell was one of the early identified symptoms. We also know that the virus causes inflammation of the lining of very small blood vessels called capillaries. And that appears to occur also in the brain. We also know that that some people have a reservoir, so the virus just hides in the crannies in the body, and so can have reemerge in waves after the initial infection. We also know that in some people that other viruses that we know are latent, so sort of lying dormant in our bodies after infection, so things like Epstein-Barr virus, which causes glandular fever when you first get it, but can cause symptoms when it reemerges. We know that that virus, EBV, can reemerge more frequently.
Shingles is another one, isn't it? People might have heard of that a little bit more.
Absolutely, absolutely. And another virus commonly appears to reemerge, something called human herpes virus 6, which is a childhood infection, which causes diarrhea and fever, and in some cases a skin rash in children under the age of 3. That one also can remain dormant and appears to reemerge after you've had COVID in the long COVID phase. We also know that we talked about antibodies being a good thing in terms of your reaction to a vaccine and protection against a second infection. But we also now know that a range of what are called autoantibodies, so antibodies against components of your normal self, are also more frequent in patients who've got long COVID symptoms. And so it's at the moment we don't have a fully formed picture, Mike, but there are multiple components to what's going on here. And I have to say, when I got COVID, I lost the ability to remember the names of things. So I couldn't remember what a fridge was called.
Stuff is scary, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Yes. Yes, so brain fog is very common, but also shortness of breath can be a symptom that lasts a long time. Right. Palpitations, so heart flutter, headache. I mean, the list goes on, actually. You know,
another one that I'd like to mention, though, is because it does seem to be, again, really difficult to carry on any sort of normal life, and that's the fatigue. And when I've spoken to people, getting across what they mean by fatigue is really difficult, you know, because we've all felt a bit tired. In fact, we felt really tired at times. But I think this fatigue is just like another step up. Any thoughts? You know, do you know why that happens, and if anything can be done about it?
Well, it definitely is part of the syndrome of long COVID. It's a sort of multifactorial issue, in that we know that the COVID virus can cause damage to the lungs. And so when people have looked at the transfer of oxygen, for instance, in the lung, that is frequently reduced in patients who've got severe symptoms of long COVID. Many people experience muscle aches, and probably because there's damage to the muscle as well. It's important, actually, to listen to your body when experiencing that fatigue. Pushing too hard with exercise, many people just want to get back to normal. And, being fit and healthy before you had COVID is no guarantee that you can immediately become fit and healthy after you've had COVID. So pacing yourself both physically, but also cognitively too. So the brain fog you mentioned, trying to think too much to do too much appears to be not the best thing to do. To actually, so pacing is an important part of what we've learned about managing long COVID in the very substantial number of people who have had it, or in some cases still have it.
So certainly, well, in my experience, when my wife had it, this wasn't long COVID, but it certainly went on for a couple of weeks. I'd see her and I'd say, you know, you're all right. And she would say, I haven't even got the energy to be bored.
I've heard that many times from, well, not those exact words, but something like that from the patient groups who represent the interests of individuals with long COVID.
Right. So, well, I suppose if people do have long COVID, feel like they have long COVID, have you got any advice in the short term?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, the pacing approach to get back to normal is really important. There is a big study going on at the moment of some drugs that we think might be helpful. So it's called the Stimulate ICP study. If people look that up, there's an opportunity to volunteer for it. Comparing three different classes of drug. One is an anti-inflammatory agent. Another is an agent that reduces blood clotting. So it's an antiplatelet agent. And the third is an antihistamine. Now you might say, well, what are histamines got to do with anything? Well, some of the immunological studies have shown that a class of immune cell called mast cells, which release histamine in response to inflammation, are disordered in patients with long COVID. And there have been anecdotal reports that taking antihistamines makes people feel a bit better when they've got long COVID. But at the moment, that's just anecdote, just word of mouth. And it's really important that we have rigorous clinical trial evidence before that becomes standard of practice. But that is ongoing. It hasn't completed yet. It's got a way to go. But that's running in a number of centres across the country.
Okay. So there's research still going on for long COVID and for treatment of COVID in the short term, and presumably for vaccines, because of, as you mentioned, this thing changes, so you have to keep up with it. But maybe a good place to finish would be, what advice, what can we all do to help? You know, because COVID is still with us. So what should I do? What can we all do to just try and get on board and keep it to a minimum?
Well, first and foremost, when you get the call, get the vaccine.
Right.
And just because you've had a vaccine before, if you're called up for a booster, get the booster. All of the ones that are available, there are three, I think, currently in circulation. That's the key to it. I think also just be aware, the virus has not gone away. It has not gone away. So be careful. Be careful around the vulnerable. Because you will remember that while many people have had symptomatic infections and they know when they've got COVID, many people don't get any symptoms. So just because somebody's not coughing and sneezing and confined to bed doesn't mean that they couldn't have COVID. So just be sensible. And if you have got symptoms and you are coughing and sneezing, wear a mask.
Right. Okay, right. That sounds like a very good place to finish. You know, two things that we can all do after you've described some of the many things that you personally and also many others have done to essentially help us all. So Nick, thank you very much indeed for chatting, for giving us a snapshot and an insight into all that. Many thanks.
My pleasure.
A big thank you to my guest this week, Professor Nick Lemoine, CBE, talking about the medical research and trials done during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. Also, a big thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio. the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.